our hopes should be. And when our hope and our trust and our reliance and our tawakkul is upon Allah, then it is the awe and the glory and the honor and the majesty of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that is created in our heart, and not the awe and glory of another human being. And so, in the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam, do not put your hope upon people. Rather, put your hope upon the owner and the creator of all of existence. Put your hope in the Almighty Allah. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma inni as'aluka al-aman yawma la yanfa'u malun wala banun illa man ata Allah biqalbin salim.
O Allah, I ask you for the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil.
Wa as'aluka al-aman yawma ya'uddu adh-dhalimu ala yaday yaqulu ya laytani ittakhadhtu ma'a ar-rasul sabila.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, "Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger."
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
When you and I and many individuals stand and say Ya Ali, it is in reference and in respect to the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi. It's an utterance that indeed you and I have practiced and have mentioned throughout our lives. You find in many occasions people enjoy mentioning and remembering the commander of the faithful. There are people today who have emerged and have come forward and complained. Some of them have stood against this particular practice. They have said, "Why is it that you say Ya Ali? Surely you should say Ya Allah. Surely you should not call the names of certain individuals." First thing I would like to say is, when it comes to calling someone, is this permissible or not? All of us agree that indeed it's something that you and I practice on a regular basis. We call each other, isn't it, by their names. In fact, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does what? He calls his prophets. He says, Ya Musa. He calls Ibrahim. He calls Yahya. Yes, the prophets, he calls them. Not only does he call them, he says, we must remember them. We must utter their name. وَذْكُرْ فِي الْكِتَابِ مَرْيَمْ وَذْكُرْ فِي الْكِتَابِ إِبْرَاهِيمْ وَذْكُرْ فِي الْكِتَابِ هُمْ إِدْرِيسِ. Allah says, remember them, mention them. Therefore, the remembrance and the mentioning of these holy individuals is something sanctioned by the Holy Quran. Allah says, you should remember them. Who are you and I to come forward and say we should not recall the name of these holy individuals, isn't it? The first thing is this. The second, tell me, aren't we, you and I, and Muslims claiming to be the followers of the Holy Prophet? And when we say the followers of the Holy Prophet, that means whatever he does, we do. And whatever he says we should not do, we will not do. Tell me, who was one of the first few who came and said, Ya Ali? It was Rasulullah. You say, where? Let me give you examples. The hadith that is mutawatir, meaning authentic, established by in all Muslim books of hadith. The Prophet of Islam comes forward and says what? He says, Ya Ali, anta minni bimanzilati Harun min Musa. Oh Ali, you are to me like what Aaron was to Moses. The Prophet of Islam says, Ya Ali, silmuka silmi, harbuka harbi. Oh Ali, the one who is at peace with you is at peace with me. And the one who fights you, and the one is the one who fights me. The Prophet of Islam would say, Ya Ali, calling Amir al-Mu'mineen, and would say what? Ana wa anta min shajaratin wahida, wa baqin nas min shajaratin ukhra. You and I are from one tree, and the rest of the people are from different trees. Yes?
كل صبح وكل اشرب ايام تبكى عيني بدمع مشتاق قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Victory Day is celebrated on May 9th in Russia as one of the most important holidays in the country, as it marks the capitulation of Nazi Germany to the Soviet Union. An estimated 27 million Soviet soldiers and civilians were killed in the Second World War, known in Russia as the Great Patriotic War, or the holiday with tears in the eyes. This year's celebrations come at a time when Russia's relations with the West are at their lowest level. NATO countries openly supply Ukraine with weapons and conduct military exercises along Russian borders. In his speech at the parade, Russian President Vladimir Putin talked about the ongoing attempts in the world to justify the crimes of the Nazis, recalled the actions of NATO in Ukraine, and explained the reasons for the military action in Donbass.
Страны НАТО не захотели нас услышать.
The NATO countries did not want to hear us, which means that in fact they had completely different plans, and we saw it. Openly, preparations were underway for another punitive operation in the Donbas, an invasion of our historical lands, including Crimea.
Putin has defended the offensive against Ukraine, describing it as a preemptive measure.
Кто разгромил нацизм?
We saw how the military infrastructure is being developed, how hundreds of foreign advisors began to work, regular deliveries of the most modern weapons from NATO countries were going on. The danger grew every day. Russia gave a preemptive rebuff to aggression. It was a forced, timely, and only correct decision, the decision of a sovereign, strong, and independent country.
And after the traditional military parade on Red Square, the president led the People's Parade. Starting 2015, the Immortal Regiment Parade is held in hundreds of Russian-inhabited localities from Kaliningrad to Vladivostok and in other countries. It became the most significant emotional event, as there is no family that has remained unaffected in Russia. All who remember and honor their own veterans of the Army and Navy, partisans, resistance fighters, home front combatants, Nazi concentration camp prisoners, come out with a picture of their beloved, those who fought or gave their lives for liberation of the USSR and Europe.
In Russia, Victory Day remains the most important public holiday of the year. It is equally revered in many of the former Soviet republics. The Great Patriotic War, which started for the Soviets in 1941, united the entire nation and still remains a centerpiece of Russia's consciousness.
Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The Palestinian conflict is the longest-running conflict on record for the United Nations. Multiple attempts at reaching a lasting peace have been and gone. Now, conveners of the Convivencia Initiative have spent years poring over a new document that they hope will become the blueprint for a movement that will push for a just peace for Palestinians.
People forget that for almost 2,000 years, Jews, Christians, and later Muslims lived in total harmony in Palestine. The Jews in Palestine were Palestinians. There was no division, there was no racism, there was no anti-Semitism. All these are European inventions.
The vision of stepping away from violence in Palestine and the region can only work if movements for peace are supported by genuine reconciliation and justice at their heart. Now, this bold new initiative being launched in London is putting true solidarity between Muslims, Christians, and Jews at its foundation and hoping for global success.
The suspicions around interfaith dialogue have also been an obstacle.
It was perhaps the first time I've seen something with a vision for Palestine, bringing together Jews, Muslims and Christians here in the UK and abroad, working together for justice and peace in Palestine. Because too often, interfaith dialogue is what I call lowest common denominator. I've been involved in activities with Jewish groups where they say, well, we can't talk about Palestine, or we can't talk about the settlements. And therefore, it shuts down genuine conversation about the causes of the justice in Palestine.
Obviously, without justice and equality and freedom for the Palestinians as well as the Jewish Israeli inhabitants of that area, there can never be a proper peace. If there's not peace in the Middle East, we know that unfortunately there are ramifications for the rest of us in all our societies.
With a growing list of supporters, the hope is to spread the spirit of convivencia.
Even a little child understands justice. If we don't stand against injustice and support each other, what's the point of coming together? And this is really a challenge to create a better future for ourselves, for our children, not just in Palestine, but everywhere else.
For far too long, division has defined the ongoing crisis. But this new initiative is forging the path to a united and just solution for Palestine and the world. Amina Taylor, London.
Israel has sold its Pegasus software to dozens of countries around the world, which allows spies to easily hack into mobile phones and retrieve personal data. Apparently, very high-profile individuals have been targeted. Now, the PEGA committee inside the European Parliament has been set up to investigate.
We cannot overemphasize the severity of this scandal. When this kind of spyware is used against innocent citizens, whether they're journalists, activists, lawyers, businessmen or politicians, and regardless where in the European Union or even beyond.
The European Commission has been slated for refusing to take action against Tel Aviv for failing to rein in Israel's NSO company, which produces Pegasus.
This is about the accountability of the European Commission to the European citizens and to the European Parliament. You have a duty to investigate.
EU Commissioner Johannes Hahn told lawmakers it's a matter for national governments.
Mr. Commissioner, if you say it's member states in charge, would you mind telling me which member state is actually in charge of investigating in this and protecting us?
EU countries Poland and Hungary have been heavily criticised for buying the spyware from Israel. But one lawmaker says the bloc turned a blind eye when it was revealed in 2019 that Germany was spying on its allies.
Do not be a hypocrite. Do not point Poland and Hungary. Point everyone. Because who was in charge of German government? Madam Merkel. You were shaking in front of Merkel. Everyone was silent.
There was even a commissioner saying, oh, haha, I have a very boring life. There's nothing on my phone.
Experts say the it's fine, I have nothing to hide argument doesn't hold water.
At the heart of liberalism is saying exactly the contrary. You always need to hide and to have an umbrella against the eye of the state.
The European Parliament's PEGA committee is due to conclude its inquiry in 11 months from now. Already there is a great deal of scepticism that the EU will take any action against Israel regardless of the findings. After all, it has always shied away from doing so in the past. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Days after launching a massive manhunt across the occupied territories, Israeli military forces arrested the two Palestinian youths who carried out Thursday's deadly operation in the settlement of Elad that was established on the Palestinian village of Mzera, central Israel. 19-year-old Asad Arifai and 20-year-old Subh Sbihat were arrested in a forest near Elad. Israeli military forces, Israel's intelligence agency, and Israeli police all took part in the manhunt.
The two heroes were arrested, but we affirm that they carried out a special operation, a move that has made Palestinians feel proud. The Israeli regime mobilized all human, logistical and technological capabilities to arrest the two youths. The Israeli military establishment will try to use their capture and publish the videos of their arrest to cover its security failure. But those two proved that the Israeli security is fragile.
Immediately following Thursday's operation that left three Israeli settlers dead and four others wounded, Israeli military took a number of decisions. First, family members of the two youths, who are from the village of Rumani near Jenin in north-occupied West Bank, were arrested and interrogated, in addition to many others close to them. Experts now say the second step would be demolishing their homes as part of the collective punishment Israel imposes in such incidents. Israel urges the move is a deterrence act to force Palestinians to quit resistance. A number of Israeli legislators and experts have promoted for killing senior Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in response to the current wave of operations, which he has encouraged. Meanwhile, the group's military wing issued a threat for an unprecedented response and a regional earthquake should Israel attempt to harm any of its top leadership, especially Yahya Sinwar.
From day one, it was crystal clear for Palestinians that the two youths would be either arrested or killed by the Israeli forces. Palestinians say what the two have done was part of their legitimate resistance. They add the operation was a heroic move and in retaliation for the Israeli crimes and the settlers' incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
NATO's hopes of securing two new additions to its military alliance are close to becoming reality as the historically neutral Nordic countries, Sweden and Finland, take serious steps towards applying for membership. The Scandinavian powers' interest in joining spiked after Russia's military operation in Ukraine began. Just the idea of a NATO expansion northwards has sparked a furious Russian response.
Both the US and NATO have made abundantly clear that they are very keen to see the two new Nordic additions to the bloc. However, with Sweden and Finland's long history of neutrality seeming to serve them very well until now, is joining the military alliance truly beneficial to their national and regional security?
NATO members, including the UK, US, France and Germany, have been applying pressure to secure the two additions. Moscow has repeatedly warned of serious consequences if Finland and Sweden join NATO, saying it would strengthen its land, naval and air forces in the Baltic Sea and even raise the possibility of deploying nuclear weapons in the area.
But what NATO is doing is to pull increasing numbers of countries within its orbit, either as direct members or as associate members, and that this then ties them to a whole number of things which they may not want to do in the future. The consequences of the end of this neutrality will not be more safety for any country in Eastern Europe. It will be an increase in the arms race on both sides. It will be an increase in military presence in those countries and elsewhere. So this is a road that people should think very, very carefully before they go down.
The coming days are crucial. Finland will decide to apply for membership by May the 12th, while Sweden, the less enthusiastic of the two, is conducting a security policy review, including the pros and cons of joining the alliance. The results are due on May the 13th. If both decide yes, the process of joining will be swift, but so too could Russia's response. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
French President Emmanuel Macron was inaugurated for his second term in a bitterly divided France. With a major portion of his voters aiming to block the far-right's Marine Le Pen, again, analysts say the first president to be re-elected in 20 years still lacks a broad mandate for more far-right economic policies. The Yellow Vests marched nationwide to send the message that they will not be intimidated or stop demanding more public opinion in public policies.
No, I'm not giving up, no. I've not been doing this for 3.5 years just so I can stop tomorrow. No way, no, no. Either we win or I die and these guys will carry on. People should never stop. They should keep going, keep going, keep going. Because this is what the governments are hoping. All governments are hoping that people give up and just let them do their thing.
The French left has put aside their squabbles and joined in a united coalition for the first time since 1936. Their goal is to prevent Macron and other conservatives from allying in another absolute majority in June's parliamentary elections. The left coalition hopes to force more compromise from a president long referred to as a liberal strongman.
Macron simply must not have a legislative majority again. The last 5 years were such a catastrophe. I hope the French people join us in the streets again because the prices of products are shamefully high, even products which are totally produced in France.
Macron's speech acknowledged the nation's disunity and said his key priorities will be the environment, the unrest in Ukraine, and European stability. The pan-European project continues to be plagued by perceptions of democratic illegitimacy and constantly rising economic inequality. A belligerent policy towards Russia may turn the Eurozone's ongoing lost decade into a lost score.
Macron's second term begins with unrest abroad, and if his first term is any guide, constant social unrest at home. pitched social battles between Macron's far-right economic plans and a French populace unconvinced by economic austerity are expected to begin no later than this autumn. Armin Mazahari, Paris.
It's a warm welcome for an end to frosty ties. It's the second time in almost 3 years that Polish Foreign Minister Zbigniew Rau has visited Iran. His two-day trip began with a meeting with his Iranian counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdollahian. The talks were held behind closed doors, while the two diplomats briefed reporters on the themes of the discussions, which ranged from economic ties to the Russo-Ukrainian war.
We talked on important issues today, on potentials for economic cooperation. We also spoke about the Russian-Ukrainian conflict. I should thank Poland for hosting Ukrainian refugees in the Russian-Ukrainian war. Iran, for its part, has since day one called for a political solution to the crisis.
The Polish diplomat's trip comes on the 80th anniversary of the entry of Polish refugees into Iran during the thick of World War II. In 1942, Iran was a major landing point for some 120,000 Polish refugees who were forced out of Poland by the Soviet Union. Touching on the issue, the top Polish diplomat said Iran's hospitality created a cordial relationship between the two nations.
We are making the 80th anniversary of the exodus of Polish refugees from their land by the USSR. I should once again thank the Iranian nation who has hosted our countrymen, providing a safe haven for them for decades.
The Polish foreign minister underlined the significance of the 2015 deal in bringing peace, calling on both Iranian and American officials to arrive at an agreement as soon as possible.
Poland and Iran are looking forward to the success of the negotiations over the 2015 deal. When that happens, we will start extensive economic cooperation with Iran without worries over the sanctions.
Poland sits on a geostrategically important part of Eastern Europe. It could act as a gateway for Iran to trade with other European states. Iran, for its part, can also act as a gateway for Polish trade with the Middle East. The two sides cited lack of knowledge as the main reason behind their low trade, hoping that this trip will set the start for broader economic ties.
After decades of uneventful relations, Tehran and Warsaw are now determined to begin a new chapter in their ties. And this last visit by the Polish foreign minister is seen as the first step towards stronger ties between the two countries, something which could redefine the course of many unresolved issues, from the fate of the 2015 deal to Iran's ties with the West. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rohingya refugees in India are in a desperate situation following renewed detention and deportation campaigns from the administration. Schools have already been detained while some deported. Intense crackdown on the community has created fear, which has led to sleepless nights amid worries of night raids and family separations. This old man, a little familiar with the local language, says, "I don't go out of the camp and prefer dying here than in a detention camp." Thousands of Rohingya refugees in India are living in an appalling situation with little or no help from anyone. Even the UN Refugee Agency is watching as a silent spectator, they said. Their men were involved in menial work for survival. However, due to detention fear, they had no choice but to abandon work and stick together in their camps.
Finding this camp wasn't easy, and upon reaching here, panic and horror was visible on every face. They got terrified upon seeing us and rushed to hidings, saying media in India is portraying their image very negatively, and this has made their survival even harder.
According to rights activists, refugee crises across the world are alarming, but this particular community continues to be an unseen victim of immeasurable extents of violence. Based on official estimates, more than 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in parts of India after fleeing a brutal crackdown against their community in Myanmar. Many refugees say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, a vicious hate campaign and their expulsion is haunting the community.
We appeal to the UN. We have no support. We need your help and the help from the Indian government to stay alive. We are in acute pain and distress. We reached here just with our lives intact. Please do not detain us, deport us, or separate us from families. rather kill us. We have no strength to face more.
Activists say the need of the hour is to protect the rights of these refugees and secure their survival, rather than deliberately targeting them and deporting them, despite the fact their lives are under threat back in Myanmar. Rights activists have urged the Indian government to formulate a uniform refugee policy. Since the country has no refugee law, they urge the Indian government to treat refugees equally, regardless of caste, ethnicity or faith. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
NATO's hopes of securing two new additions to its military alliance are close to becoming reality as the historically neutral Nordic countries, Sweden and Finland, take serious steps towards applying for membership. The Scandinavian powers' interest in joining spiked after Russia's military operation in Ukraine began. Just the idea of a NATO expansion northwards has sparked a furious Russian response.
Both the US and NATO have made abundantly clear that they are very keen to see the two new Nordic additions to the bloc. However, with Sweden and Finland's long history of neutrality seeming to serve them very well until now, is joining the military alliance truly beneficial to their national and regional security?
NATO members, including the UK, US, France and Germany, have been applying pressure to secure the two additions. Moscow has repeatedly warned of serious consequences if Finland and Sweden join NATO, saying it would strengthen its land, naval and air forces in the Baltic Sea and even raise the possibility of deploying nuclear weapons in the area.
But what NATO is doing is to pull increasing numbers of countries within its orbit, either as direct members or as associate members, and that this then ties them to a whole number of things which they may not want to do in the future. The consequences of the end of this neutrality will not be more safety for any country in Eastern Europe. It will be an increase in the arms race on both sides. It will be an increase in military presence in those countries and elsewhere. So this is a road that people should think very, very carefully before they go down.
The coming days are crucial. Finland will decide to apply for membership by May the 12th, while Sweden, the less enthusiastic of the two, is conducting a security policy review, including the pros and cons of joining the alliance. The results are due on May the 13th. If both decide yes, the process of joining will be swift, but so too could Russia's response. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
If the U.S. were genuinely interested in some sort of political solution to the Israeli apartheid practices regarding the Palestinians, nothing would be easier than to just step aside and let the world punish Bennett for his brutal policies, which amount to war crimes. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Juan Cole, journalist. This article is published under the heading U.S. Double Standard on Display in Tepid Response to Israeli Regime's Theft of Palestinian Land. Stay tuned for more. The deputy spokesperson for the U.S. State Department, Yanlina Porter, recently condemned the Zionist regime's announcement that it would build 4,000 further housing units in the Palestinian West Bank. That is, it would steal land owned by Palestinian families and bring in squatters from the Zionist regime to squat on that land. The full lack of seriousness in the U.S. regime on this issue is obvious. The Zionist regime maintains that the Palestinian West Bank belongs to it, even though no such baseless claim is recognized in international law. The Israeli newspaper Arab 48 reports that the Israeli civil administration of the occupied Palestinian West Bank will decide on 3,988 new housing units for Zionist squatters on Palestinian land next month. This additional building of housing infrastructure on Palestinian land will ultimately further displace and impoverish Palestinians, the rightful inhabitants of the land, Palestine. The fake regime of Israel can behave this way, in brazen violation of the international law governing how occupying powers treat the people they occupy during wartime, only because the U.S. regime runs interference for Israeli regime in international bodies. Otherwise, the world would put sanctions on the fabricated regime of Israel for invading and occupying and trying to annex Palestinian land. Separately, we understand that the Zionist regime announced a meeting to advance new West Bank settlements for West Bank settlement units for May 12th. The Biden administration has been clear from the outset. We strongly oppose the expansion of settlements, which exacerbates tensions and undermines trust between parties. The Zionist regime program of expanding settlements deeply damages the prospect for a two-state solution. So then, Ron Campis, the Washington, D.C. bureau chief of the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, asked what the repercussions will be for the Zionist regime in going ahead with the new housing settlements. He wanted to know how it would affect President Biden's planned trip to the occupied territories in June. Hint, there are no repercussions. Ms. Porter replied, as one might expect with platitudes so excruciatingly mind-numbing that no one else would want to raise the question again for at least a century. I will just say from here that we have been clear about the need to avoid unilateral steps that would exacerbate tensions and make it more difficult to preserve the viability of a two-state solution. I have nothing to comment about the president's upcoming trip, unquote. There is no viable two-state solution. The fabricated regime of Israel has plunked down so many hundreds of thousands of squatters in Palestinian population centers that the territory looks like Swiss cheese on a map. It is just something American politicians say to kick the can down the road while the Israelis grab more and more of the West Bank. It is sort of like telling a team of bank robbers in the midst of a heist that you really regret their unfortunate actions and urge them not to damage the liquidity of the bank beyond the point where both the robbers and the bank owners can coexist. If the U.S. were genuinely interested in some sort of political solution to the Israeli apartheid practices regarding the Palestinians, nothing would be easier than to just step aside and let the world punish Bennett for the brutal policies, which amount to war crimes. Washington wouldn't even have to be proactive itself. The Zionist regime prime minister, Naftali Bennett, made $200 million with software and would feel the pain if he were sanctioned. But official Washington is so in the tank for Israeli apartheid that making such a suggestion sounds outlandish.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahroudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati,
there is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamari that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. This is the teacher, I'm Ata, the host of this program. We've been in the studio for today's discussion to discuss the life and works of another Shia dignitary, our two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about the life account of one of the most outstanding Shiite dignitaries of the 13th and 14th Hijra century. He is no one but Sayyid Abul Hasan al-Isfahani, the outstanding faqih, we can say, and religious authority, who, after the demise of the late Ayatollah Naini and Hayri Yazdi, he became the general religious authority of the Shiite world, Sayyid Abul Hasan al-Isfahani. Okay, let's start with the early life. What information do we have, Sheikh Ziyaniya, about his early life?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hasan al-Isfahani was born in a village close to the city of Isfahan in the year of 1284, according to lunar calendar. And as his name is clarifying, he was related to the city of Isfahan. His origin roots in the generation of the seventh Imam of Shia, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salatu wassalam. And even his grandfather was one of the most notable and outstanding scholars at his time and was the student of Muhammad Hassan Najafi, mostly known as Sab Jawahir. Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hasan Isfahani started his Islamic studies in the Islamic Seminary of Isfahan. And although his family were not agree with Islamic studies, but he continued this field. And when he finished his primary studies in Isfahan, he moved to Najaf and continued his studies, Islamic studies, in the Islamic Seminary of Najaf.
That's right.
And here he got familiar with Akhund Khorasani, rahmatullah alayh, and Akhund told his father that you may have the rest of your sons but please let this one be mine. Mm-hmm. And Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani from that moment on continued to be a student of Ahund Khorasani for 17 years.
That's right.
And this is the moment that he is introduced to the Islamic world as a scholar, a great scholar.
Yes.
And after some years, he became the Imam of Jama'ah prayer in the shrine of Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam.
And then the Marja'al Am, isn't it?
After some years.
We can say he becomes the general religious authority of the whole Shia world in the city of Najaf. This position, Sheikh Mahdawi, was really significant, especially for Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Isfahani, because after Akhund al-Khurasani, it is passed to, we can say, people like Sayyid Muhammad Kazim Tawatabai, Mirza, we can say Muhammad Taqi Shirazi, you know. And it is after the late Shirazi that Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Isfahani is selected, isn't it, as the religious authority.
Yeah, as far as I read in his biography, your
turn. Okay, so talk a little bit about this general position for us. I mean, when you become the Marja'a Alam, this position is really important for the Muslims.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is a very noble position, as you mentioned. When we consider the time of Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani, we see that among his teachers and also among his students, we can consider a lot of students who have reached the level of scholar or mujtahid.
Yes.
They are close to become a marja. So what is the actually difference between a mujtahid and marja? Mm-hmm. It's only one step to be taken by mujtahid to become a marja. So from the marja to become a marja'e amme, meaning that sitting at the position which none of the other mujtahids are going to claim for that position. Mm-hmm. So it makes that, okay, we have only one marja in this position. So all people, I mean, believers will follow that single mujtahid. So it will create an umbrella, vast umbrella, which will include all of the people, including laymen, mujtahid, and so you don't you are not going to face controversy and a split among the people. Definitely. Regarding their issues.
Okay.
So that was a very high-ranked position, but we have to consider the lifestyle of Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani. I'm sure that when we go to Abu Badr, Sheikh Ziya, he also will narrate for us some of the memories, very beautiful, noble memories of his lifestyle that will put him to be taken as a role model.
That's right.
Not only for the talibah, I mean students of the yes. seminary schools,
yes.
even for the ordinary people.
Okay.
For example, in one of the, I just want to say one of the memories, which has something to do with his social life.
Okay,
this has not become of being a marja.
Mm-hmm.
So it is narrated that in one of the Salat al-Jama'ah congregation prayer in the shrine of Amir al-Mu'mineen, a person attacks his son, mm-hmm. I mean the son of Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani, and yes. kills him.
Yes.
So at that position, you are sitting at the position of Marja'a Amma, even you don't need to go to the police and take this guy and then take him to the court and mm-hmm. start judging against him. You are at the position of Marja'a Amma. You can actually revenge as it is lawful. I mean, we have right. the retaliation
yes.
concept, which is qasas. But what does this Marja'a do? He forgives.
Yes.
It is not understandable for us. We may talk easily that someone is going to forgive the murderer of his son, but when we consider all of these details, that somebody is not a very simple man. He is the marja amme.
Yes.
And that other person has killed his son and he forgives.
Mm-hmm.
So it shows that he was not
the
at the position.
Status and position.
Yes, even it was his right to benefit from his right that was given or granted to him by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, by Sharia, to go for retaliation and qasas, but he forgives.
Mm-hmm.
This is one aspect of his life. And then another aspect to show his actually insight and also to show his discern thought against the those who are against the Muhabbin al-Ahl al-Bayt, those
right.
who are against the Shia.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody asked him, okay, it is asked from Ayah Shubayri Zanjani.
Yes.
the living marja right now. We're benefiting from his presence in Qom. He's leading the Salat in Holy Shrine of Bibi Masuma in Qom. Somebody asked Ayatollah Shubairi Zanjani, why a marja amma should not go for the Hajj? Mm-hmm. Because it is common that Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hasan Isfahani, he didn't go for the Hajj.
He didn't go for Hajj.
That is obligatory upon all mustati' people.
Yes.
I mean, those who have this ability to afford it financially and physically, they have to go for Hajj. So, Ayatollah Shubairi Zanjani, he is saying that Sayyid Abul Hasan Isfahani didn't go there. Why? Because he was of this view that if I go there, while I cannot revive the right of those four imams, I mean, I cannot reconstruct and give respect, full respect. I am there next to the tombs of those four imams, and their tombs, I mean, their shrines are collapsed.
Yes.
This presence will authorize what Saudis have done.
In Jannatul Baqi.
Yes.
Of this month that this program is on air, is the commemoration day for
8th of Shawwal.
8th of Shawwal, the demolition of Jannatul Baqi by the Saudis and the Wahhabis. So, because he was not capable of reconstructing and, spending enough respect for the infallible imams.
Yeah, you said, okay, they may take advantage, saying, okay, because it was close, historically, it was close to the collapse of those things. So if I go there, by my presence, even these leaders, the Wahhabi leaders, we say, okay, we did that thing, we collapsed the shrines, and we see the marja'am of you, Shia,
come here,
have come.
Without saying anything.
Yes. Okay. So my presence
it's might... It's better not to go there now.
Yes.
Okay.
So he stayed away from the practicing obligatory worshipping act in favor of what? Of giving this insight to the followers that was actually usury and ghasb of the rights of Ahlul Bayt.
That's all right. Thank you very much for this information. It was very kind of you. Politically and socially speaking, he was after, we can say, the independence of the people of Iraq and the Muslims and the Shiites who are living over there. Sayyid Abul Hasan al-Aswani as a marja was anti-colonialism, anti-imperialism on that time. Politically speaking, Sheikh Ziyaniya, let's talk a little bit about this aspect of the life of Sayyid.
Okay, yes. Beside his scholarly life, he had really a fruitful political life. And let me give you some examples. For example, when the nation of Iraq wanted to stand against the oppression of colonialism of England, Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hasan Isfahani was the marja' that gave a verdict, a fatwa for people that this movement is wajib upon the shoulder of Muslimin to stand against the oppressors. Another important point is that after the World War I, the First World War, because there were too many, destructions all over the world, especially in Europe, and in Muslim countries even, the ambassador of Britain came to visit the late Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hasan Isfahani. And late Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hasan Isfahani accepted his request, the ambassador's request to have a visit with Ayatollah. And when the ambassador came, it is quoted that the prime minister of Iraq at that time, that was Nuri Sa'id, he was also accompanying the ambassador. And when all the people were sitting in the gathering, in the meeting, and it was a, official meeting, the ambassador of England said to the Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hasan Isfahani that, yes, this world was really deconstructive for your country and for Muslim nation. And the government of England took an oath that if they could have victory in this war, they would give a donation and a gift to you to spend this money for the benefit of Muslim Ummah.
Yes.
And then he gave a check of 100,000 dinars to the late Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hasan Isfahani. And all the people are visiting this and observing this event. Okay. Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hasan Isfahani accepted the check and put it under
the mattress
that he was sitting on.
Yes.
And he started to speak, and he said, yes, this war was really fatal and was really deconstructive for the world. And I know that Europe also is really suffering from the disadvantages of this war. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that your country also faces with many problems. And if you let me, I want to give you also a gift. And then Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani brings out the check that the ambassador has given to him. And then he put another check on it with the amount of 100,000 dinars and says, you know that we are also in shortage of resources, but accept this gift from the Muslim Ummah and spend it in your country to help your people, because I know that there are too many poor people nowadays in England.
That's all right.
And okay. Nuri Said says, when we get out of the house of late Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani, I hear the ambassador saying that we wanted to buy the marja
of bribe, in fact.
Yeah.
Yes.
We wanted to bribe the marja of Shia population in the world, but he flipped the table and he disgraced us in front of all the people in the official meeting.
That's right. That's all right. This is really the true. When you become the marja of the whole Muslims or the Shia world, then you have to be considered with even these trivial points. I mean, as a marja, you have to have it in your mind. And at that time, we know that Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Isfahani was such a person. What information do you have about his scholar life? I mean, his compilations and books, Shaykh?
Yeah. Sometimes for our listeners to really figure out the position of the marja, because of the historical distance among them and the lifestyle of Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani, it might be a bit difficult for them. But for now, if we speak of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, they will definitely understand who we are talking about.
Yes.
His position in knowledge and scholarly life.
Yes.
So now I'm going to take one example in order to make the position of Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani known to our listeners. We know the book Tahrir al-Wasila.
By the late Imam Khomeini.
Yes, by the late. So what is this book exactly?
Okay.
This book exactly is a commentary of Imam Khomeini on what? On the book of Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani.
Mm-hmm.
So it shows the level of knowledge of Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani, because when you take one book and then you put your comments on that book, okay, meaning that for now, for that time, I mean the time Imam Khomeini was actually developing his knowledge and his scholarly life. So he take the book of Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani because he...
Vasilatun Najat.
Yes, Vasilatun Najat. Because he sees that book in a position that could be taken and could be commented on introduced to the followers as the fatwa'i book.
That is a faqih fatwa book. Okay.
Yes.
And Imam Khomeini, by writing a commentary,
you
can also compile Tahrir al-Wasila. Okay.
Yes. And right. Also regarding the usul.
Yes.
His discussions and taqrirat, I mean, the compilation of his lessons by his students is really noble, of high rank among the students of Hausa nowadays. And he is mainly known of having very strong lessons on usul, because he was a direct student of marhum Akhund
Khorasani. That's
author of Kifayatul Usul. It is one of the famous usuli books, which is taught in a high advanced of the Hausa.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziania. We can say the Hajj 9th, 1365, according to the Hijja calendar, is a day that this outstanding marja passed away. His body was taken from Al-Kazamiya to Najaf al-Ashraf, and he was buried in one of the courtrooms around the holy shrine of Imam Ali alayhi salam. May Allah bless the soul of the marja Sayyid Abul Hassan al-Isfahani, the compiler of Wasilatun Najah. Thank you much, Sheikhs, for your presence in the program, and thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com. /EN Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode introducing another Shia dignitary. God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Allah.
Muallim.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.